meeting here this afternoon. Here for the New Zealand, you are up next. I'll introduce the panel so that you understand who you're hearing in front of. Commissioner McLeod is councillor in the Wanaka Board. Christopher Nixon is a planning consultant from Christchurch. He's been doing work on heritage issues and what Christchurch planned recently. And I am a candidate from Wanaka. I'm able to disclose my first career is in archaeology. I have done a research essay on heritage landscapes, and I'm a member of ICOMOS. So, there is no bias on the panel.
Statement for this hearing. Heritage New Zealand is an autonomous Crown entity with statutory responsibilities under the Heritage New Zealand Kahele Tonga Act 2014 for the identification, protection, preservation and conservation of New Zealand's historical cultural heritage. This act confirms Heritage New Zealand as New Zealand's lead historic heritage advisor. Heritage New Zealand achieves this purpose in several ways. We're custodian to 48 historic places around the country. We compile the New Zealand Heritage List, Karangi Kariru, which identifies New Zealand's significant and valued historical cultural heritage places. Heritage New Zealand regulates the modification and destruction of archaeological sites through the Archaeological Authority process. Heritage New Zealand engages in the RMA and other statutory processes to improve the regulatory environment for historic heritage. With regard to the proposed Queenstown Lakes District Plan, Heritage New Zealand is generally supportive of the approach that QLBC has taken with the Heritage Chapter. Heritage New Zealand sees particular value in the work that has been done on the statements of significance for heritage precincts and heritage landscapes. These assessments provide clarity in relation to the values that the district plan is seeking to protect and will assist in providing certainty and clarity for users of the plan, as well as those involved in decision making about activities within these areas. Heritage New Zealand is also particularly supportive of the emphasis in the objectives, policies and rules on managing cumulative effects and incremental change. In Heritage New Zealand's day-to-day involvement in resource consent matters, the impacts of incremental change to a heritage item are very apparent. In some cases, such change can lead to a point where the heritage values of that item that was originally appreciated have been largely eroded over time. This is particularly relevant in the Queenstown Lakes district, where strong economic drivers can demand frequent changes to the use of heritage buildings and their surrounds. Linked to this is the need to have good information about the values of scheduled items in order to ensure that over time the most important values are appropriately managed. Through recent assessments undertaken by the Council's consultants, the Wakatipu Heritage Trust, and information upgrades undertaken by Heritage New Zealand, the body of information about schedule items is growing. Heritage New Zealand's submissions and today's statements are intended to address areas where we consider the heritage provisions could be strengthened and clarified. With me today to summarise their pre-circulated hearing statements and answer any questions I have, Jane O'Day, the Heritage Advisor for Planning, who's on my left, Matthew Schmidt, the Regional Archaeologist, on my right, and Heather Bocker, the Heritage Advisor Registration, on my far right. So thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
That's pretty straightforward. So.
My turn?
Yes.
My name is Jane O'Day. My qualifications and experience are outlined in my written statement. This statement concerns planning matters associated with the proposed Queenstown Lakes District Plan and Heritage New Zealand's submission on the PDP. The primary matters addressed in my pre-circulated statement are the statutory framework for the management of historic heritage, the Heritage New Zealand Sustainable Management Guidance, matters pertaining to Heritage New Zealand's submission and the notified and Section 42A report recommended revised chapter version of the provisions. In some cases, I have recommended amendments to the proposed provisions. My statement then covers Heritage New Zealand's approach to notifying landowners affected by Heritage New Zealand's submissions on the proposed district plan. I have considered the recommendations in the Section 42A report and note the numerous changes to the proposed chapter that are recommended in the report. I generally consider the revised version of the chapter to provide greater clarity and certainty than the notified version. Furthermore, the proposed amendments streamline provisions that have the potential to duplicate provisions in other chapters of the plan. Overall, I'm in support of the Section 42A report recommended revised chapter. For the sake of brevity, I'll focus this summary on matters where I have recommended changes to the recommended revised chapter version of the heritage provisions as set out in the Section 42A report. I recommend some amendments to the rule framework for archaeological sites scheduled in Section 26.10 of the Inventory of Protected Features. The proposed amendments, including an additional rule, are intended to better manage activities which have the potential to adversely affect sites and their settings or extents. Furthermore, they encompass activities which may not necessarily be addressed or considered under the archaeological provisions of the Heritage New Zealand Act. For example, new buildings and structures within the setting or extent of place of a scheduled archaeological site. In such cases, the district plan has the potential to perform a role that the Heritage New Zealand Act may not necessarily extend to, but where there is the potential for significant adverse effects. The Section 42A report recommended amendments to the notified version of the explanation of the development activity would mean that new signage within the extent, place, or setting of a scheduled heritage item would not specifically require consent. I consider that new signage has the potential to compromise the surroundings of historic heritage and should be controlled. In my written statement, I have therefore recommended amendments to the Heritage and Signs chapter to address this matter. I note Ms. Jones's comment in her summary of evidence provided to you on Monday that amending the Signs chapter would be outside the scope of the current process. Whilst I understand the reason for Ms. Jones's view, it is my opinion that the topic of heritage is intended to be comprehensively dealt with by the current process. There should therefore be scope to consider pertinent matters such as signage within the setting or extent of a scheduled heritage feature. My opinion is reinforced by the knowledge that the district plan signs chapter was reviewed reviewed in 2014, and as I understand it, there is no intention to review this chapter again in the near future. Furthermore, I note that signage was a matter that was contemplated in the notified version of the heritage chapter as a component of development within the Kirklees Hall setting, and accordingly, I do not consider that any person would be prejudiced by the inclusion of the provision I have recommended, whether in the heritage or signs chapter. I recognise that inclusion in the heritage chapter would mean that the signs chapter would no longer be a complete district-wide chapter. This is an unfortunate outcome of the stage district plan review process and the district plan format, and could be potentially be remedied through a later plan change. Finally, I would like to touch on Heritage New Zealand's approach to informing owners where its submission affects privately owned properties. Heritage New Zealand wrote to the owners of all properties affected by its submission. The letters sent to these parties explained how Heritage New Zealand's submission on the plan affects their property, explained that there is an option to lodge further submission, where to find further information on the QLDC website regarding the PDP and how to lodge a further submission, and provide contact details of Heritage New Zealand staff who could answer any queries. Copies of the letters sent and a summary of responses is contained in section 16 of my written statement. I draw this to your attention so that you are aware that the affected landowners have been informed of Heritage New Zealand's submission and the opportunity to lodge further submissions. I understand that there were discussions yesterday at the hearing regarding the mill house, and that the withdrawal of Heritage New Zealand's submission on this item affects your ability to investigate the background to the scheduling of this item. If appropriate, I would like to reverse the withdrawal of Heritage New Zealand's submission on this point, on the understanding that the background to this scheduling is unclear, and it would be appropriate to look into this before confirming the status of the building in terms of the district plan schedule. To assist with any investigations into this, Heritage New Zealand is happy to provide any background information that we have. Overall, and subject to the amendments discussed here and expanded upon in my written statement, I consider the provisions set out, the proposed provisions set out in the Section 42A report will provide an appropriate framework for the management of historic heritage values in the district. And I'm happy to answer your question.
Just on your point regarding Mill House, as I recall it, Heritage New Zealand's submission was sought to change from Category 3 to Category 2.
Yes.
And the Mill House Trust, just to have the representative appeared yesterday, he actually preferred for it to be removed from the register in total. Although, as he opposed, he had known no more of the claims New Zealand's submission, say, it would be really a matter of whether it stays three or moves to two. Well, I think because I was trying to improve the volume, because the Heritage New Zealand submission sought the classification to change between the two. The Mill House Trust could only support or oppose that, so they were opposing it. But the opposition could not go any further than it being remaining Category 3.
Right, so
does adding further information by
the question of whether it can be removed from the schedule through this process.
It's outside scope anyway.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Yes.
So in that case, whether Heritage New Zealand withdraws its submission on that point won't make a difference.
Won't make a difference to the outcome on the Trust's further submission. No. The question really then for it is, does Heritage New Zealand wish to provide further information in which case we have to receive it this afternoon, on the Mill House in support of the submission? Or do you want to just revert back to...
In support of Heritage New Zealand's submission?
Yes. To reclassify it?
No, because, well, we don't have, it's not part of the Category 2 Heritage New Zealand list entry.
Right.
And so we don't any longer seek the upgrading of that item from Category 3 to Category 2.
Okay. So that's fine, we'll just leave it at that. I understand that you were trying to be helpful to the Mill House Trust, but I...
Can I just clarify, are you withdrawing the withdrawal of the withdrawal?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, we've been above that recently. Do you have any questions?
Yes, there's a few I'd just like to follow up on, which have come through the questions to council officers and to Jackie Gillies this morning.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'd just like to raise is the, as from understanding it, what your understanding of the issue is, but the plan is proposing to have a way of better defining what demolition actually means, and there's a suggestion of something like a 30-70 formula.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, I appreciate there's no perfect answer to this, there never will be. It's always going to be a matter of making an arbitrary judgment of some form.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just be interested to know what your view is on that approach.
Well, as you say, I don't think there is a perfect scenario. That there's a whole range of different things that need to be taken into consideration when something's proposed for demolition, and you know, some fabric might be old, some fabric might not be, so it is difficult to put definitions around that, and I felt that the percentage approach was not a bad way to go, and I also thought that that was supported by the fact that even if the decision or the interpretation on a one-off basis was that something was a partial demolition rather than a full demolition, or an alteration rather than a partial demolition, was that the sort of the objective and policy and rule framework set up to support that are actually robust enough to still enable a good consideration of what the actual effects will be.
Mm-hmm.
And whether, even if it's an alteration, say it was the most significant 25% of the building that was being demolished, that there would still be enough scope there to consider the seriousness of that.
Yeah, because as I understand, it was partly in response to a submission that had sought that demolition and relocation be rolled into the same category as alterations, I think it might have been the name is that it thought that watertight investment was one, and there might have been another one as well. And I guess what I was sort of going through my mind is that whether using, and again, remembering figures are difficult, whether if you applied that, say, to Arcadia or to Skipper's Road or to different kinds of scenarios, whether that you're comfortable that that doesn't let something get through the door that shouldn't get through the door.
Can I sort of add to Jane's answer? So it really comes down to the information, the understanding of the site and the values. That's where the most critical part of that. So the question, so you can have the 30 to 70, but if you understand the values of the site through assessments and you understand what values are being affected, and the 70%, which is under, if you rent up to 70% partial demolition, that could be the 70% proven to be of little or no heritage value. And so with that, it does, using a percentage, using any equation really, it still comes back down to understanding the values of the site we're affecting and So I suppose that was the point of my initial point this morning around, this afternoon around how important it has been for the council are building up an understanding of the values of the sites they're protecting, because it's only then that all parties understand what they're affecting, what the impacts are, and whether they're reasonable or not.
Yeah, one of the things I think the Chair mentioned in our previous questions is that if we were to contemplate this approach, it may need to be fixed to 70-30 as of a particular date. It might be the date the plan becomes operative. Otherwise, a clever developer could come along and do 30-70 formula, and then 3 years later do another 50% to 70%, that kind of thing. So something that had occurred to us.
We've actually, Matt was just saying, we've sort of, this ties in with archaeology as well, with our processes around incremental demolition.
Yeah, I mean, under the archaeological provisions, we've got the demolition of buildings and part demolition of buildings, and we're working with Crown Law, because there are pretty much 100 buildings are archaeological sites. And what we found, we couldn't put any percentage on it because it had to be done on a case by case basis. Because you could have a building that 100% of the building, 20% could have been 1860s, and the other bit might have been 1920s. In the 1860s, that's a really important bit. And so it came out that it was very, very difficult to put into our legislation percentages of what's considered a partial demolition. Because our Act doesn't cover partial demolitions. It only, for pre-1900 buildings, you only need an archaeological authority if it's for demolition of the whole building.
Yeah. Well, the situation we were looking at here was more saying that it applied from the date that this plan becomes operative, so it might, for sake of argument, 1st of January 2018, say, and then it would mean that from that date onwards, that's when you'd be measuring your percentage demolition, rather than going right back into the past. So you could say, oh, well, you know, back in 1958 they added this on, so you can discount that, so it wasn't what we were contemplating. So this question relates with the issue of setting. Now, I notice in your evidence you've suggested using the words integral to the site, which is very similar to this debate that was held in Christchurch. I think that kind of wording was I think the hearing panel will be heading towards there. I can't say they would because they've made a final decision. But I'm just a bit, in terms of extent of place, the definition that was given to me of what that meant means a setting when it's defined in plan form. Is that what you'd understand it to be? Because we would explain to us that a extent of place means a setting which is defined in plan form. Is that how you'd understand it?
In the context of this plan, yes, but I haven't, in general, I haven't sort of given any thought to whether extent of place needs to be something that's mapped or not. But in the context of this plan, I think that's a sort of a good way of just differentiating between those items that do have mapped extent boundaries and those where the setting is something that needs to be sort of interpreted or more of a case by case.
I think the argument that was put to us was that the extent of place was more appropriate where you had either a very large or very complex site. We had an example before lunch at Millbrook, which is a very large site, as you'll appreciate, and you've got a number of historic buildings, and there's one isolated one, Orley Cottage, I think it is, and there's four others on the main part of the site, and the only way to make sense of that would be to define it and plan for it. I guess the key question I have for you is, in terms of a setting, in other words, it's not defined as an extent of place, is it your view that would basically be the legal title of the site? In other words, it would be the cadastral description?
I think it doesn't necessarily have to be the same as the legal title. It can be smaller, but I think for the purposes of the plan, it shouldn't be any wider than the legal title. Just because of reasonableness, really.
The next question I'm going to ask relates to archaeological sites and having a rule in the plan as well as the powers that Heritage New Zealand has under its Historic Places Act.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues we're going to have to consider here is whether that's appropriate or not, because on the face of it, having regard to Section 32, it's going to create a duplicate consent system using two processes that are in fact somewhat different. I don't think there's an appeal right, or a clearly specified appeal right, arising out of the HPT legislation, whereas there is under the planning legislation, and also raises the possible but probably not likely scenario that if the council and HPT came to different conclusions, how would you ever resolve that? So I'm just wondering what your thoughts were on that subject, because I understand you do support in principle the council having its own rules.
I just wonder whether we maybe answer that up to Matt.
I'm happy for that, but that's what, all right, if you could, but if you take note of that question, because it's something we definitely want to see addressed. Ms. Gillies this morning was talking about the issue of relocation and versus demolition, and her view was that the two things, even if they have the same consent status, should be treated separately because they're different animals. Is that a view that you would agree with?
They are, just to clarify, they are treated separately in the proposed plan, aren't they?
Well, no, not entirely. There's one of the rules, 266, really deals with them in the same rule. Well, this is in the section 42A amended version of the plan, not the notified version. It's on page 8.
There is a relocation within the site, but there's relocation without the site.
Mm-hmm. I think that they are, they should be treated differently in terms of assessing the effects of the proposed activity. Clearly, whilst relocation isn't ideal, it's preferable to total demolition in most cases, I would think. So, in that sense, yes, they should be treated as different activities with different sort of effects that go along with them.
I suppose the point around relocation is that you're looking at a level of mitigation by relocating it, so we're often looking at where the item is going as much as where it's leaving. So the integrity is safe as much as possible, and that we're not creating a future risk to the relocated item. So although it's not quite as great as there's demolition, it nonetheless, not considered properly, can have the same effect. It can be relocated to a place that's taken appropriate and will nonetheless, the building at risk.
It looks to me as if those items, those activities have sort of been grouped together in this table more because the activity statuses are the same than that they are actually seen as being.
Well, her view was that even if the activity status is the same, they should be treated as separate activities because of the fundamentally different nature of what is actually going on between demolition and relocation. It doesn't mean to say that relocation is a good thing, but it's a very different thing.
Any other questions? There's one archaeology which I neglected. The percentage, I know we've discussed the percentage in terms of demolition of the building as a measure of, and I accept the fact that it all comes down to case by case and what we're actually demolishing. But that, is there any assessment been done on cumulative effects in any other areas? So that you know, as an example, just in terms of using that as a guideline, it's that death by a thousand cuts. An example I used is what's happened to McNeil's cottage. In that there was a note, which is essentially now degraded to the point where it's starting to fall off the register. Is there some...
Are you asking, is there a sort of a, an understanding of sort of more widely in other sort of district plans and things where we're looking at a similar, what that effect might have?
Well, that, were you looking at that and that issue of the cumulative effects or death by a thousand cuts has actually been identified, and there's only mechanisms that have been used elsewhere to address that?
Well, I suppose, again, the most important mechanism is just understanding the value of that particular site. So, yeah, McNeil's is a very good example where, if you look at the reason why we originally put it on our list, it was because it was a rare example in Queenstown of a cottage. It's sort of setting, garden and everything, and so we look at it now. And it's particularly, as I said in my introduction, it's particularly relevant here where you've got just sort of, you know, every 3 years, McNeil's has usually had another resource consent application for changes to the exterior, setting, signage, and so on. So certainly on a case-by-case basis, we see that pressure being applied. It is incredibly important that the statements of significance for sites are very clear on what the values are.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't have those, then we don't have a baseline. And I think, you know, the point you're probably raising partly about whether you can go back to 1954 and someone could be cutting out and say, well, the site was already degraded back then. If we know at the time that it's put on the list what the values are, then that's going to be like the line in the sand. And we should always, everyone, including us and council, should be constantly referring back to those values all the time, not just what the present value is, but what the original values were to be protected. So it does come back to that statement of significance.
Jackie Gillies again this morning was talking about there's a definition with heritage fabric and characteristics, and some work being done to try and put in some examples of where that damage could be considered to be too much or considered detrimental to the fabric. But her recommendation was to remove pretty much the examples, because people tended to, and this is in rules 26.6, part 1, ABC, beneath it. And her argument was that people then tend to focus on those to the detriment of the overall picture.
So I think those examples, where those examples are potentially useful, is where you don't have an understanding of the values of that particular site. So, you know, for me, having examples, I'm not saying that they should be in the definition, but having those examples allows people to understand where characteristics may reside and how fragile that might be. So they might be, you know, literally the light switches, because that was, you know, the first installation of electricity in the Waikato Basin, and those came out of the catalogue, and there's no others to be found in the area. That was identified on the statement of significance, and you'd be looking down to that level, and it's often those levels that are affected most easily through incremental change. I think if you were to remove those, you do have to be very reliant on the, you know, on those statements of significance for each of those properties to be very clear what the values are, that, you know, and how, and what intangible values are sort of tangibly manifest in the site. You really do need to know those. I haven't personally got a clear view right now whether they should stay or go, but it is useful to at least be able to see sort of the various levels at which value can be manifest, like in fixing and fittings and patina, which is often a very fragile and
seems again to be coming back to that original statement of significance of each thing.
In your evidence in chief, on page 11. In paragraph 13.6, you're dealing with earthworks, and in chapter 22, I had this discussion, I think, with Ms. Jones. Chapter 22 is not part of the proposed district plan, and even though earthworks will come into the district plan at a later stage, in all probability, the first part of the district plan will become effective, if not operative, before there is any earthworks chapter in effect. That being the case, do you think there's a need to retain some earthwork provision in the heritage section, at least in the interim?
So is that because the earthworks chapter is under appeal at the moment?
No, it's because it's in the operative district plan.
Oh, it's in the operative district plan.
Not in the proposed district, and there is no earthworks chapter in the proposed district plan at present. I think it is actually.
It was reviewed not that long ago.
And I think it is under appeal as well. I'm not sure if that's been resolved, but that's. Yes, I know that there are several. The council has done several changes that, in a practical sense, are unhelpful.
I just am aware that when the earthworks chapter was reviewed, there were new provisions inserted in relation to earthworks within heritage landscapes. And it has always referred to earth. I think even prior to that, it also referred to earthworks on the site for schedule item as well. So I don't. If that chapter is operative, and I don't think that those particular provisions are under appeal.
I'm not sure. That's a bit confusing.
If that chapter's sort of operative and in use, then I'm comfortable that working in tandem with what's in the heritage chapter, that should be adequate.
Okay. So in that sense, you see it as different from the signage situation, which equally was a recent plan change.
Yes, because the signs chapter, at the time that was done, the heritage chapter hadn't been reviewed, so the proposed new rules for settings and extents of place weren't contemplated when the signs chapter was reviewed. So we now have rules about settings and extents of place, which I think should be, they need to meet up with the signs provisions.
Okay. That's fine. I'm just checking that.
Yes, because when the earthworks chapter was done, they knew about the heritage landscapes and addressed those at that time. So.
Okay, my other question is in relation, it's on page 13, and it's paragraph 13.12. And it's about relocation of an archaeological site. And I'm wondering how one relocates an archaeological site.
Well, Matt will be able to tell you because he's going to watch one getting relocated.
He's on Friday, one's being relocated.
But is it still an archaeological site when it's relocated? Because we had this discussion with someone else the other day, I can't remember who it is.
Once it's moved, it's not.
It's not an archaeological site. That's right.
Once it joins the land, it's an archaeological site. You pick it up, move it, it's now a piece of heritage.
Yes.
Put it somewhere else.
So, which means that the terming it as relocation of an archaeological site may be an improper use of language.
Well, an archaeological site can, it's an overall sort of description which can be also encompass features as well. So one thing can be an archaeological site within itself, so a small building.
Yes.
And so you literally are moving the site, picking up and moving it. Mm-hmm. Not that common, but it has been done.
Yeah.
Wayne has said bypass, they move lots of sites. Picked up and moved the houses, so yeah.
Okay. That was all my questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Kia koutou katoa. Ko Taranaki tō maunga, ko Mataao te awa, no Wanti Koti ahau, ko Matthew Smith, tōko Henu Goa, no Riga, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. My name is Dr. Matthew Schmidt, Qualifications Experience outlined by written statement. The statement concerns archaeological matters associated with the proposed Queensland Lakes District Council Plan 2015 Heritage and Health Submission, PDP. My statement addresses the proposed management of archaeological heritage sites under the PDP and whether this will ensure the effective management of significant archaeological sites in the QLDC area. Consider three matters in my written statement. How sites protected by the Heritage New Zealand Pōhewa Tonga Act 2014 and the Resource Management Act 1991. The proposed archaeology alert layer and why the most significant archaeological sites should be listed in the PDP inventory of protected features. The protection and management of archaeological sites. Section 42 of the Heritage New Zealand Pōhewa Tonga Act is illegal to modify or destroy an archaeological site without an archaeological authority granted by Heritage New Zealand. Hence, providing a blanket protection of archaeological sites anywhere, no matter what the origins are and how significant they are. The archaeological authority process can involve as little as three key persons in making a determination. And the application process does not require public consultation. Although the archaeological authority process can be used as a tool in the management of archaeological sites, it is focused on the effects on the site itself and the recovery of information. In making a determination, Heritage New Zealand is limited to considering the effects on the archaeological site under strict criteria, which is noted in section 59 of our Act. However, under a district plan, the effects on a listed site may take a wider berth, such as the visual or bulk intrusion of a structure on site, the moving of a pre-1900 building, partial demolition of a pre-1900 building, or the impacts on a large complex site which extends over multiple legal boundaries. My evidence expands on the reasons for this, and I'll provide examples now. Okay, the archaeological alert layer limits the pins. Use of an archaeological and cultural alert layer set out in section 26.3. But one of the PDP which will be based on cultural alert layer for planning identification purposes and New Zealand Archaeological Association database. So Tōpuni areas, Noonga areas, statutory acknowledgement areas identified in the Ngāi Claim Settlement Act. Based on maps from the deed of settlement, it's a very positive addition to this plan. I agree with section 42A report with respect to the benefits it will make to the management of archaeological sites, and ensuring those persons undertaking any sort of developments in the district are aware of their legal obligations with respect to sites. It will significantly reduce the possibility of accidental damage to sites, and I think this information could also be useful for limbs and pimps as well. I believe the archaeological alert layers also have the advantage of ensuring district plan schedules do not come cluttered with numerous archaeological sites with varying significance, or where no significant statements are available. Such schedules should concentrate on highly significant archaeological sites. In conclusion, it could be argued that the Heritage New Zealand Pōhewa Tonga Act provides an overarching protection of archaeological sites for the nation as a whole, with the RMA providing a protection and management mechanism for highly significant aquifer sites at a local level. In regards to individual sites scheduled in the PDP inventory, I particularly support the inclusion of sites proposed by Heritage New Zealand for scheduling, as being the Rico's Point Chinese Gold Mining site, Rory Mead Bridge Abutment, Wongong's Terrace Historic Area, and Sir Hoy's Big Beach Claim Historic Area. I made a wee note at the bottom, I accidentally put in the Frankton Mill site because I got my mills mixed up. So, sorry for that one. And I'm not familiar with that site actually.
It's a rock in the middle of the Colorado River.
Yeah, that's the other mill site.
Yeah.
Right, this is a different one.
Oh, this is a different one. Yeah. Now, the question I want to raise with you is I had an interesting discussion with Dr. Port about yesterday.
Yeah.
Are sites that are post-1900, which can only be investigated by archaeological means, archaeological sites?
Has to be pre-1900.
That's in terms of your legislation.
Oh yeah, that's right. Sorry.
That's in terms of your legislation.
Yes.
In terms of real life.
Yeah.
In the real world.
If you
were not working for Heritage New Zealand,
yeah,
you were working as an archaeologist and you were given a post-1900 site to examine, would you call it an archaeological site?
I actually would, because I believe that it shouldn't be stuck at 1900. I think it should be up around, there's a significant amount of New Zealand heritage, or the changes in New Zealand happened between about 1900 and 1940. There's a lot of amazing architecture and, you know, Depression sort of sites, and World War One in particular, and that receives no direct protection in New Zealand, so
well,
you only get it through a district plan.
The issue, the area we were discussing, I don't know if you're familiar with it, the Glenorchy Heritage Landscape.
Yep.
Where almost all the archaeology is post 1900. And the initial suggestion by the submitter was that it wasn't archaeological sites, but Dr. Court's evidence was that we were only investigated archaeologically. And I think we reached agreement by the end of the hearing that they were archaeological sites, and we might need a different definition in the district plan to make that clear. And
yeah.
What I'm taking from you is that you would agree with that position.
Yeah, I do. In fact, we're a little bit unusual because in Asia in particular, such as Thailand, it's anything over 50 years old.
Mm.
In other areas, it's a rolling 50 years, and the other ones are rolling 100 years.
Yeah.
So it used to be in our old act until 1993. So, yeah, and in Europe, for example, if you're investigating World War I sites, the approach is completely archaeological.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, yeah, I think that's right. Oh, yeah, we can, under our Act, declare a heritage place an archaeological site after 1900. So, if it's 1920, we can do it in what's called a declaration.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done about seven since 1993, maybe eight. And some people ask why so few. It's because we tend to do them if we've got landowner support, because the landowner really has to buy into the significance of the site. Yeah. But we do have that talk.
Is that under a particular section of the Act that you exercise that?
Yeah, there's, I think it's section 10 under here. Section 43.1.
Well, it's interesting, it's something I wasn't aware of at all. Appreciate it's not an easy thing to rush in and do, but it does offer another alternative.
Yeah, it does. We did it with the whaler space on Stewart Island, and the owner was really concerned about, at that site was occupied in 1926 and 1931, there were massive whale chaser propellers on the beach, and there have been attempts to take them. And it was a really significant site, so the owner wanted the significance recognised, but also another tool for prosecuting anyone found on his property. Because it was a post-1900 site, all you could get for was theft, really. So that was good for the property.
Oh yes, you'll recall the question I asked earlier relating to devil's advocate question in many ways about the issue of having both consents required under the district plan and under the HPT legislation. Now, first question of clarification, I take it you're talking that would apply to particular identified sites, it's not a across-the-board thing, because, for example, archaeological sites may be discovered by chance, someone yeah. digging, and they're required to let you know and go through a process like that. Yeah. But you're not suggesting that apply across all archaeological sites, or are you?
No, not all archaeological sites. Only particular sites, so on the ones listed on the district plan, for example. Yeah, they're the real ones you want to keep an eye on.
Are there any other district plans you're aware of that have this dual system and have had to deal with consents under it?
I'm
aware of some district plans that do, and I think it's becoming more common in second generation plans. Hamilton City is one that you could look at. They have a similar sort of approach. I think Gisborne also might. And they're the ones that I've sort of looked at particularly. The DCC have introduced a schedule of significant archaeological sites. Haven't gone so far as to introduce rules around those other than if you don't have an archaeological authority, you need a resource consent.
Yeah, because I can certainly see the value of the archaeological alert layer. I guess the main concern was that the potential tangle you could get into with two separate procedures, particularly in the situation of this would be possible with HPT, Heritage New Zealand, and the council came to different conclusions as they would resolve something like that. But I would imagine at the end of the day, it's Heritage New Zealand that has the whip hand, or must have the whip hand.
I've been with Heritage New Zealand for 10 years, and then I was consulted before that, and I've never come across it down here. Often the person's got the archaeological assessment, and the council must look at it, and we've always communicated over it. And so I haven't come across it yet. I can't recall any. Yeah.
It is a risk. And in a case where a resource consent is granted but an archaeological authority is declined, then and assuming that they are for exactly the same thing, which they might not be, because the rules, the district plan rules, and the archaeological authority do sort of look at slightly different things. The archaeological authority takes precedent over the resource consent. However, on the other hand, an archaeological authority could be granted for something that the council and the community don't want to see happen, and in that situation, a resource consent could be declined, and that might be considered to be an appropriate outcome.
Just remind me, certainly under the previous legislation, applicants for archaeological authorities had appeal rights, but they still have appeal rights.
Yeah, so they can appeal the decision.
And third parties, how far does that extend?
It's only to the direct person who's applied, and if it's an iwi site, those parties are in consultation,
right.
Consent from iwi.
Yep.
So it's very, very narrow. Very narrow.
But in a situation then where an authority was refused and a resource consent granted, then it could be appealed to the Environment Court and vice versa.
Yeah.
That's both situations and resolved at that level.
Yeah, and it's down here in this area, it's never happened, actually. There's never been an appeal from authority here.
Mm.
It's quite rare.
I presume that in the situations that Commissioner Nixon is talking about when an application comes in, that the District Council officers talk to you in any event, do they?
Yeah, they do. They do. The and the Acts work very differently in that the reason we talk really closely is because when something comes in under the resource consent, there's a lot more parties involved. Mm. And so that's why I think there's never been much conflict down here, because typically if I do an ARCOG assessment, I'll contact council if I realise there's resource consent. And so we'll have a chat about it. And usually with the applicants, we'll sit down here and talk about it. You know. So, okay, well, how are we going to work this?
I suppose the other point just to make is that obviously there are sites that are already on schedules around the country which are sort of archaeological sites, and they're a ruin, so we're already in some ways dealing with those in those situations anyway for a resource consent and for the archaeological authority process, and if you're working so well they consider different things, but we tend to work with councillors and the applicants.
My final question was, it's really one for my own knowledge really, background. Are there pre-European sites, archaeological sites, that have been identified in this district?
Yeah.
There are. So
yeah,
some
there are.
Found.
There's quite a few Kiwi sites around here. In total, there's 1,008 recorded archaeological sites, but of course there's probably about 4,000 or 5,000 actually out there, sort of thing. And of that, I think, I was trying to think the percentage of those, is probably about maybe 10%, somewhere around there, be pre-European, I'd say. Very hard to find and record. But so they do pop up. Yeah. We had one in Franklin actually pop up just a couple of months ago, down with the new developments. Contract contact me about 2 years ago, a contract found mile bones and looked like they'd never covered it up. So eventually through the grapevine and found out and recorded it. But yes, they do pop up now.
Okay, thank you.
Questions?
Commissioner McCrae? I had one which was, we had a representation from another submitter about the Bunaki site, and one of the arguments they were saying was that the ongoing mining of that site could actually help to enhance almost that site. That's just from the new.
Oh, the Shelag mines.
Yep.
Yes, I've surveyed up there. You can get a balance between modern mining and the other heritage sites, yeah, for sure. In fact, from my experience over the years, sometimes when you've got a heritage site, they're showing an old operation. A modern day operation can be quite good as a comparison to people visiting those areas.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is possible. There's also some mining areas where you've got hard rock mining. You can see all the equipment out the front and the attics and things like that. But nobody's ever going to see what's inside because it's just too dangerous.
Yeah.
And so again, you can strike a balance where people can go in and remine that, and it might be destroyed.
Yeah.
But the other visual portion, which is safe to see, everyone will still see and be preserved. So yeah, you can. Definitely get a balance with that.
Cool.
And that works with some mitigation as well, these, so that they, part of the mitigation for these works is that they do them sort of emphasise and protect other sites that are of value so people can see them.
You can get some good data actually sometimes with these. At Macrae's, for example, nobody knew how they were the timbers or how they were strengthening the mine shafts in there. So when Oceana went through, they were able to get in there and open one of these old shafts and get out some really interesting data on where the timbers and all that were coming from.
Yeah.
For that. A lot of it was straight timber.
Cool.
That's
discusses the heritage values of several individual historic places. The Heritage New Zealand list identifies New Zealand's significant and grounded historical and cultural heritage places. It is maintained by Heritage New Zealand. It was formerly known as the New Zealand Historic Places Trust Register of Historic Places, Historic Areas, Wahitapu and Wahitapu Areas. Its size, scale and national focus make the list one of the most important historical information resources in New Zealand. Importantly, the list in itself is primarily an identification measure rather than a plan tool. The list does not directly create regulatory consequences or legal obligations on property owners and does not directly create specific rights or control over property. Practical protection of places and areas is provided through regional and district plans. I therefore consider it appropriate for the district plan to recognise and manage effects on sites entered on the New Zealand Heritage List by including them in the proposed district plan inventory of protected features. The list is divided into five parts: historic places, historic areas, Wahitūpuna, Wahitapu areas. Historic places on the list are assigned as Category 1 or Category 2. Category only applies to historic places. I consider that settings form part or contribute to the heritage values of a heritage item. The current practice for entries on the New Zealand Heritage List is to identify settings through description and by drawing the physical extent on a map. This is often the legal land parcel, although it may also be a line drawn within a legal land parcel. This is often the case for very large legal parcels, for example in rural historic properties. I note that the Section 42A report proposes the inclusion of some mapped setting extents for items scheduled in the inventory of protected features. In several cases, this has come from the New Zealand Heritage List, including, for example, PDP item 574 Storm. I support the inclusion of this information. In my opinion, interiors usually form part of the heritage values of a place. The current practice for entries on the New Zealand Heritage List is to identify interior features that contribute to the significance of a place through descriptive text and photographs. Each individual feature is not usually itemised, but the layout and general features, for example, such things as pressed metal ceilings, stained glass windows, elaborate light fittings or notable timber panelling would usually be mentioned. I agree with Richard Knott's evidence that Category 1 places should always be Category 1 in the QLDC plan. These places have been through a rigorous process to identify their values, and in general their values are universal and tell a significant story. I agree that generally Category 2 heritage places should be Category 2 QLDC places, but I recognise that there may be items for a Category 3 QLDC listing may be acceptable. For example, there may be situations in which the protections that Category 2 QLDC listing offers is not required. For example, when there are no interior or significant interior values, as is the case with the Stone Line Channel, which is PDP item 42. But I believe the assessment should take into account of the values of the place. Sections 8.4 to 8.13 of my written statement outline my views on individual heritage items, which I will not repeat here. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. In paragraph 12, you say you agree with Mr. Knott's position. We have one instance, at least, where there's a Category 1 item under the Heritage New Zealand list, which is Category 2 proposed in the district plan, and that is Skipper's Road. Would you agree with Ms. Gillies that that should be changed to Category 1 to be consistent with the Heritage New Zealand classification?
Yes, I think we did block, we may have lodged a further submission on that point as well. Supporting her submission.
Yes, just it's the big subject of interiors. It's your chapter, your paragraph 11. And I'm aware that in the Christchurch review, that was a fairly major issue relating to that. Now, it does appear from reading this, and I don't want to read things into it that are not there, but the HPT takes a more, I guess we could call it, conservative position, perhaps, in the council, because I think I sort of understood from Ms. Gillies that if the building is heritage significance, it's not really necessary to list what's inside or identify what's inside, but just to list the buildings. And I suppose the difficulty that creates for planners and regulators is that we are frequently told by building owners, well, the interior of my building has been completely modernised. Examples of that were perhaps the little stone cottage in Brisbane Street, which looks like whoever owns that has virtually totally modernised the interior, and there are examples where that's happened as well. I'm reading what you're saying here, that it's rather preferable to try and give some indication of what those valued features of a building interior actually are.
Yeah.
So that's definitely HBT's preference.
Yes, we would, if I was assessing a place, I would be trying to do that. Jonathan might want to elaborate more on interiors. He's usually dealing with owners that are dealing with incremental change and what values for a key type to start off with.
Yeah, so again, I suppose it just comes back to the assessment, whether it's you know, council basing their assessment on our list entry report, or whether they're it's a scheduled item, then the statement of significance for that item should be clearly indicate what the values are. If the whole item's being protected, then you would hope all parties, including the applicant and the council assessing it, and any affected parties could look up the statement of significance and understand, yes, these are the values, or it is just the front room which has not been altered, so we all know where the value resides, so then if the application comes in for alterations to the other part of the house, everyone sort of knows that the effects on those values are going to be limited.
A list entry report the ones that are to the right would normally have a photographic, at least a partial photographic record of what was important at the time and what was there.
One of the, perhaps a good example of the dilemma we're faced with there in terms of the listing, I think it's an upgrading Arcadia to one. Now, that's a very iconic building from the exterior, but probably the most iconic building up in that area, I suppose, it's the sheer presence that the thing has. But we don't know much, or don't appear to know much, about what the interior values actually are. Now, Jackie Gillies this morning gave a bit of a verbal description of them, but we don't have much beyond that. I guess what we're a little nervous about is upgrading it to Category 1 when we don't know what the implications are for the interior of the building. Apparently the current occupants occupy a little extension. The rest of the house is just largely empty as we understand it. But
and in original condition.
And supposedly in original condition, but we don't have anything in front of us in the way of photographs or information.
Assessment would be useful.
Yes.
It would be vital to have an assessment to do that, to ensure that you're being provided certainty.
I think as a deeply fascinating place, just from the outside,
it
would be interesting to get a proper assessment of it.
Can I just say that one point about interiors, which often we're dealing with protecting exteriors of buildings, we're often sort of looking at, sometimes we get confused with sort of townscape values, but the interiors are incredibly important because they're the very reason why the building is there, the use sitting inside them. So, Arcadia, the exterior, the fact that it was a home, the interior is as much part of the story. And so, interiors are incredibly important to understanding a site, the building structure. But, to say that the importance is knowing what those values are in the interior so that there can be certainty from everyone where the values reside, and therefore what the effects are going to be, and we can constantly refer back and forth as changes happen over time to know, those are the values we first put on the schedule for.
Mm. In other words, it's understanding the values that you're trying to protect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, I have no other questions.
Thank you very much.